Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. We are talking about part 5, chapter 6 of Anna Karenina, They Got Hitched. I think I said that in the previous discussion, or was it the one before? They actually are hitched this time. Predictions, will it last? Will it be a happy marriage? I'm Norwegian says the chapter opens with the mention of an elaborate and complicated psalm. Christian music from the last couple of centuries is pretty whack. That older style of Orthodox church, however, is absolutely beautiful. This one is beautiful too, though it's one of Allegri's compositions. There's a couple of links there to songs. Should we play one? Let's play one. Let's play one of these whack Orthodox Church psalms. Is that how they said? Russian Orthodox, let my prayer arise, chant. Wait, where's my volume? That's enough of that. Echoey. A lot of reverb in a church. That was just four people singing. It sounds huge. Christian rock. Surprisingly... What are we talking about here? Christian rock. Yeesh. Surprisingly, Christian metal tends to be really good. Silent Planet's Garrett Russell is probably the best lyricist within the genre. I never pass up a chance to bring them up, so here's the lyrics of one of their most explicitly religious songs as an example. You don't have to read them, Amanda. I'm not going to. It's just swerving a little bit out of the conversation into a Christian rock lyric, but I'm sure they're very good. Do you know who's Christian rock these days? Kanye West has gone all Christian. Whoa. You seen that guy? What is he doing? And that was all the conversation we had this chapter. I nearly said this week. This chapter. Not a lot of combo. That's all right. Let's just keep reading then, shall we? They're married. That was really all there was to it. No predictions. No one had a prediction on will it last and will they be happy. I really can't tell. It could go either way. You know, they could continue through the book as this kind of example of happily ever after, or it could all go awry. I'm 50-50, really. I just don't know. Chapter 7 goes like this. Vronsky and Anna had already been traveling together in Europe for 3 months. They had visited Venice, Rome, and Naples. Naples? Is that how you say that? Why do I feel like I said that wrong? And had only just reached a small Italian town where they meant to make a longer stay. A handsome head waiter, his thick hair greased with pomatum and parted from the nape upward, dressed in a swallowtail coat with a wide lawn shirt front and a bundle of charms dangling on his rotund stomach, with his hands in his pockets, his eyes screwed up contemptuously, was answering a bystander's questions in a severe tone. Hearing steps ascending the stairs at the other side of the entrance, the waiter turned and recognized the Russian count who occupied the best rooms in the hotel. He respectfully took his hands out of his pockets, bowed, and said that the courier had been, and that the business of renting the palazzo was settled. The steward was ready to sign the contract. "Ah, I am very glad," said Vronsky. "And is the lady in?" "The lady has been for a walk, but has now returned," replied the waiter. Vronsky took off his soft brain? Vronsky took off his soft, broad-brimmed hat and wiped his perspiring forehead and his hair, which he had allowed to grow halfway down his ears and wore brushed back so as to hide his bald patch. After an absent-minded glance at the man who was still standing there watching him, he was about to go in. "This gentleman is a Russian and was asking about you," said the head waiter, with a mixture of vexation and and the impossibility of evading his acquaintances anywhere, and of desire. Sorry, with a mixation of vexation. Frickin' hell. Let me try that a third time. With a mixture of vexation at the impossibility of evading his acquaintances anywhere, and of desire to find something to distract the monotony of his life, Vronsky looked around again at the man who had first moved away and then halted, and at the same moment the eyes of both brightened. I think Tolstoy was drunk when he wrote this this chapter. These sentences are like, I don't know, brain twisters. Golenishev. Vronsky, who was Golenishev, his fellow student in the Corps des Pages. In the Corps, Golenishev had been a liberal, had left the Corps a civilian, and had never served. On leaving the Corps, the two friends had separated and had met but once since then. On that occasion, Vronsky found that Golenishev had chosen some high-flown liberal activity and therefore felt he must despise Vronsky's profession and activities. Consequently, Vronsky had then treated him with the cold, proud aloofness of which he was master, which meant, you may like or dislike my way of life. It is a matter of absolute indifference to me, but if you wish to know me, you must respect me. And Golenishev, contemptuously indifferent to Vronsky's attitude, so that meeting ought to have separated them still further. Yet now they brightened up and exclaimed with pleasure at recognizing one another. Vronsky would never have thought he could be so pleased to see Golenishev, but probably he was himself unaware how bored he was. He forgot the unpleasant impression left by their last encounter, and with an open and joyful countenance held out his hand to his old schoolfellow. A similar expression of pleasure replaced the former anxious look on Golenishev's face. "How pleased I am to see you," said Vronsky, a friendly smile disclosing his fine white teeth. "I heard the name of Vronsky, but I did not know which Vronsky. I am very, very pleased. Come in. Well, and what are you doing?" "Oh, I have been here over a year. I am working." "Ah," said Vronsky in an interested tone. "Well, come in." And according to the usual way with Russians, instead of saying what he wanted to hide from the servants in Russian, he began speaking French. "You know Madame Karenina? We are travelling together. I am now going to her," he said in French, attentively watching Golenishev's expression. "Ah, I did not know," Golenishev replied in a tone of indifference, though he was quite aware of it. "Been here long?" he added. "I?" 3 days, answered Vronsky, still attentively scrutinizing his friend's face. "Yes, he is a decent fellow and looks at the matter in the right way," said Vronsky to himself, understanding the meaning of the other's look and the change of subject. "I can introduce him to Anna, as he sees the matter rightly." During the 3 months he had spent abroad with Anna, Vronsky, when coming across new people, had always asked himself how the new person would be likely to regard his relations with Anna, and in most cases he had found that the men he met understood it in the right way. But had he and those who understood the matter in the right way been asked what this understanding amounted to, they would have been much puzzled how to reply. Excuse me. At bottom, those who, in Vronsky's opinion, understood it the right way did not understand it in any special way, but behaved in general as well-bred persons do with regard to all the complicated and unanswerable problems which surround life on every side. They conducted themselves properly, avoiding insinuations and inconvenient questions. They pretended to understand completely the significance and meaning of the situation, to countenance and even approve of it, but to consider it out of place and unnecessary to explain all this. Vronsky at once guessed that Golenishev was one of that sort, and was therefore doubly pleased to have met him. And Golenishev behaved to Anna, when he had been introduced, as well as Vronsky could have wished. Evidently he avoided without the least effort everything in conversation that might have sounded awkward. He had never met Anna before, and was struck by her beauty, and still more by the simplicity with which she accepted her position. She blushed when Vronsky showed Golenishev in, and the childlike flush that suffused her open and handsome face pleased him exceedingly. But what pleased him most was that at once, and apparently intentionally, to prevent any possibility of misapprehension in the stranger's mind, she called Vronsky simply Alexis and said that they were about to move into a house of their own, called a palazzo, which they had just taken. This straightforward and simple attitude toward her own position pleased Golenishev. Noticing Anna's good-natured, bright, and energetic manner, he thought that, knowing both Karenin and Vronsky as he did, he quite understood her. He thought he understood what she herself was quite unable to understand, how, though she was the cause of her husband's unhappiness, and how abandoned, and had abandoned him and her son, and lost her own good name, she could feel energetic, cheerful, and happy. "It is mentioned in the guidebook," said Golenishev, referring to the palazzo Vronsky was taking. "There is a fine Tintoretto there, one of his later period." "I say, the weather is glorious. Let us go down and have another look at it," said Vronsky to Anna. "I should like to very much. I'll just go and put on my hat. You say it's hot?" she asked, stopping at the door and looking inquiringly at Vronsky while a bright flush again suffused her face. From her look, Vronsky understood that she did not yet know what attitude he wished to adopt toward Golenishev, and he was afraid she might not have behaved suitably. He answered with a long and tender look. "No, not very hot," he said. She thought she had understood him completely, and above all, that he was satisfied with her. She gave him a smile and went out with rapid steps. The two friends looked at each other, and in both faces appeared an embarrassed expression, as if Golenishev, who obviously admired her, tried but failed to hit on the right thing to say about her, and as if Vronsky both feared and wished that he should succeed. "Well, and so you have settled down here," said Vronsky in order to begin a conversation. "You are still busy at the same thing," he went on, recollecting that he had heard the other was writing something. "Yes, I am writing the second part of Two Principles," said Golenishev, flushing with pleasure at the question. "To be quite exact, I mean I am not yet writing, but am collecting the materials. The book will be much fuller and will deal with almost all the questions. We in Russia are slow to realize that we are the inheritors of Byzantium," and he began a long and heated explanation. At first Vronsky felt uncomfortable because he did not know even the first part of Two Principles, which the author mentioned as if it were well known, but later on, when Golenishev began expanding his view and Vronsky was able to follow him, even though he was ignorant of Two Principles, he listened with interest, for the man talked well. Yet Vronsky was surprised at and sorry to see the irritable excitement with which Golenishev spoke on the subject that interested him. The longer he talked, the more his eyes flashed, the more hastily he retorted on imaginary opponents, and the more agitated and offended became his face. Remembering him as a thin, active, good-natured, and noble boy always at the head of his class, Vronsky could not understand the cause of the agitation, nor approve of it. What most displeased him was that Golenishev, a man belonging to good society, should put himself on the same level with certain scribblers who irritated him and made him angry. Was it worthwhile? He did not like this, but nevertheless, he felt that Golenishev was not happy and was sorry for him. Signs of distress, of insanity almost, were apparent in his mobile and rather good-natured face when, without even observing that Anna had re-entered the room, he continued expressing his views with haste and warmth. When Anna returned with her hat and mantle on and stood beside him, toying with her sunshade, with quick motions of her beautiful hand, Vronsky, with a feeling of relief, turned from Golenishev's eyes, which were fixed on him plaintively. With renewed love, he glanced at his charming companion, so full of vitality and joy. With an effort, Golenishev recollected himself, but he was at first dejected and morose. Anna, however, who at that time was amiably disposed to everyone, soon revived him by her simple and cheerful behaviour. After trying several topics of conversation, she led him on to the subject of art, about which he talked very well, and listened to him with attention. They walked to the house they had taken and looked over it. "I am very pleased about one thing," said Anna to Golenishev, when they had returned to the hotel. "Alexis will have a nice studio. You must certainly have that room, Alexis," she added, having understood that Golenishev was to be on an intimate footing with them, and that there was no need to pretend in his presence. Do you paint? Inquired Dolinishev, turning quickly to Vronsky. Yes, I went in for it long ago, and now have begun a little, answered Vronsky with a blush. He is very talented, said Anna with a pleased smile. Of course I am no judge, but people who do know him say so. There we go, another chapter down. Italian holiday. Sounds lovely. Wish I was there. Have your say about this one over at the Hemingway List subreddit. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.